Cookie Roberts is with us. She is one of America's leading broadcast journalists, a longtime reporter, news analyst, author, and commentator for NPR, and a regular on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. She is in town this week to be on a panel called The Power of Women, and she joined us on Tuesday, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Cookie Roberts to the roundtable. What a delight.
Lovely to be with you, Joe.
We've spoken many times. It's always been over the phone, so right. It's a delight to meet you in person.
In the flesh.
How do you define this stage of your career now?
Old. I'm old.
But it's basically analysis,
yes.
Commentary.
Right. In terms of my day job of broadcasting, it is. It's analysis, commentary. More analysis than commentary, but it's both. And then my other job is writing books, and that's a very time-consuming and rewarding job.
We'll get to the books in a second. When it comes to the analysis, so I'll ask you the obvious question, which is, what is it like to be in Washington during this very, I think by almost all accounts, a tumultuous time?
I think that's fair to say. That's a nice word, tumultuous. It is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And everybody says every day, oh my God, you know, now this has happened. And every single solitary day, you find yourself thrown off. You think you might be doing X, and then Y happens. Today we're talking on Tuesday. Today it looks like the president's nominee for Veterans Affairs is toast.
Right.
So you have something that just comes up and smacks you in the face every day.
Does something like that happen because of a lack of vetting? Which means, and I'm just going to broaden this out to mean the normal things that were in place for so many administrations and so many decades and even centuries that
of both parties.
On both parties, that there would be a checks and balances that normally you wouldn't even see a candidate for an office get that far because they would know these things already.
That's right. And it started really with the transition. The immediate past presidents have done a quite good job of trying to get their ducks in a row during the transition. Now, it was tough for George W. Bush in 2000 because of the prolonged election going to the recount in the Supreme Court and all of that. But even so, he had people in place who were working on it and looking at the people who could be heading up agencies. Right. And also, he didn't have, nor did Barack Obama, the wholesale departures from agencies. So what we have now, for instance, at the State Department, it's home alone. I mean, there is nobody in those deputy secretary positions. John Sullivan, who's the acting secretary at the moment, is pretty much it. And so you've got a double whammy. You've got no preparation for the top jobs and a lot of the second jobs being vacated.
So, again, we're taping this on Tuesday, but we assume that as the week goes on, probably the Mike Pompeo that will be confirmed and move through. Is that an example of someone who is qualified?
Well, there are people who will certainly dispute that, and you'll hear that in the floor debate, but he's someone that they're comfortable with. He's been in Congress. They confirmed him for the CIA. He has not done anything at the CIA to alarm them. He has also given testimony on Capitol Hill that is very much more in line with the way the leaders of the Foreign Affairs and Foreign Relations Committees think than with the way the president thinks. And so I think that he is... he's someone that they might disagree with, but that they can certainly see in the role.
Have you ever, when you look at just what has happened here and what is going on, the big story to come, of course, is the meeting in North Korea. As it stands right now, it's impossible to say what can happen, isn't it?
It's totally impossible to say what will happen. Now, we've had in the past summit meetings where very surprising things happen. It happened with Reagan and Gorbachev. But this one is so dicey. Our relations with North Korea are so fraught, and the president's never been in this kind of position, and neither has Kim. And so then the question is, you know, how does each of them behave? And nobody knows the answer to that question. And the idea that, you know, you can just sort of strike a deal the way you do in real estate is a little bit harder when you're dealing with nuclear weapons.
So the question, of course, I think that is on the minds of most people when you think about long term, which is when you have this much tumult, when you have this much turmoil and spinning things on their heads, is there then ever normalcy again?
We don't know the answer to that. And part of the answer will be, does President Trump get reelected? Because if you're talking about 8 years, then it becomes more difficult to return to what was before. Now, a lot of people don't want to return to what was before. I mean, they were very clear that they were totally fed up with that.
Right.
And that this was, you know, a change election that they were ready for. The part that concerns me, Joe, much more than any of the stuff going on sort of in the agencies and all of that, or even in policy, is the sense that facts aren't facts, and that truth isn't truth. And we could be losing a whole generation to the basic scientific evidence of facts. And that's very worrisome, because if you can't agree on facts, I don't see how you ever govern or get to some sort of policy agreement. You can look at the same set of facts. I mean, New York's famous, wonderful Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan is the person who said, of course, you know, we're all entitled to our opinions, we're not entitled to our facts. And you can look at the same set of facts and come up with very different policy solutions, but it doesn't mean that you ignore the facts. And that's where we are at the moment, and that's very worrisome.
And that does seem to be, I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying about the agencies and so forth. You look and go down that rabbit hole. But we are seeing that across the board of that seems to be the rule of we're not going to worry about the facts.
Which is very worrisome, because
right.
Facts matter. And they matter in all kinds of ways. But they particularly matter when you're talking about life and death. You are talking about things like nuclear bombs. You're talking about climate change that is affecting all kinds of aspects of life. You talk about things like vaccines. All of those things are very important in our society. And if you start just saying, making up stuff about them or denying that they exist, you're getting yourself in a heap of trouble.
Here's one of the things that I don't quite get, and I'm looking to you, the expert, to help me out here.
Oh, good.
You have a Republican president, you have a Republican House, you have a Republican Senate, and we're still paralyzed. We still have gridlock, the same gridlock that we had when we had a Republican House and Senate and a Democratic president. How does that happen?
Well, actually, it's what the founders wanted to happen to some degree. They were never interested in efficient government with everything being passed lickety-split, because that is an invitation to monarchy. And they were definitely against that. But it is true that you have differences among the parties. Of course, the Senate is quite evenly split. And the Senate does have the filibuster rule, which was a direct decision to protect minority rights, regardless of who is in the majority. And so it makes it harder to get things done. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes, you know, there's an old saying, legislate in haste, repent at leisure.
Okay, I get that part, but it does seem also that there is nothing, that everything then becomes a fight.
Right.
That everything then becomes a protracted
right.
fight. And okay, we fight and fight and fight, and we get Obamacare, and then we fight and fight and fight and try to repeal it.
And it's all about the fight. It's not about the policy.
Right.
And that's the part that's so dispiriting. I mean, yesterday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware switched his vote, Democrat, switched his vote from being against Pompeo to present. And he did that because his good friend, Johnny Isaacson, Senator, Republican senator from Georgia, was absent in order to give the eulogy at his best friend's funeral. And Coons said, I respect Johnny. I disagree with Johnny on a lot of things, but I respect him. He's a good friend of mine. I'm going to do this so this nomination can go forward out of this committee with a favorable recommendation and get to the floor. And I'm doing it for Johnny. That used to happen all the time. It so seldom happens now that it moved the chairman of the committee, Bob Corker, to tears. He couldn't get over it.
Right.
And that's what we're missing. We're missing any sense of comity, of camaraderie, of some sense that, you know, I might disagree with you, but you're not evil. And I can listen to your point of view, and we can come together to get something done.
And where you would expect there to be, you would think that, again, given the makeup of the presidency, the House, the Senate, you would think the Democrats would be louder in their outrage than they're being now.
Oh, they're pretty loud. And they're, you know, the other thing that's true, Joe, is both parties are divided.
Sure.
And each one is having to listen to its base. And right now, the Democratic base is moving decidedly to the left and is getting louder and louder. And that also makes it very tough to get anything done in the same way that the loud conservative Republican base does. And I think that they are expressing outrage in a whole variety of ways. But, you know, they're somewhat hamstrung by math.
Let us talk about the president's base. What do you make of that right now? Is that what it was in November of 2016, or is it evolving?
It's evolving both for and against him. The against part tends to be suburban Republican women who are turning off of him in large numbers, very large numbers. The for part is traditional Republicans who didn't much like him in 2016, but have come to feel like his policies are working for them, particularly the tax cut and deregulation. And so they are becoming more Trumpite as the men are becoming more Trumpite as the women are becoming less so.
We're talking to Cokie Roberts, who is our guest. And of course, when we started this conversation, we were talking about one aspect of your career now, of course, being an author and writing books. You have many books to your credit, including Founding Mothers and Ladies of Liberty and Capital Dames. What got you interested in writing about women in our history?
Well, I love history, and I have to read a lot of history to be a good correspondent covering politics in Congress. And the founders are invoked all the time in the Congress. And by the way, Joe, about 99% of the time incorrectly invoked. But really. But so as somebody who was studying a lot of what the founders said and wrote and meant, and as somebody who's not only covered women in politics, both as politicians and voters, but also grew up in an era of seeing very influential wives and mothers in politics, I started getting very curious about what the women of the founding era were doing while the men were doing what they were doing. And I went to find out about it, and really, with the exception of a couple of good biographies of Abigail Adams, there was nothing. It's changed since then. It's gotten better. But at that point, there was really nothing. And so for me to learn about what the women were doing, I had to do the work myself. And once I'd done that, I might as well write about it.
And what have you found in consistencies and as far as the ultimate impact that women have had on the formation of this country?
Oh, enormous. From the beginning, I mean, you had Abigail Adams basically just berating John that he wasn't declaring independence fast enough and thinking that they were a bunch of lily-livered cowards, that they were afraid of the Brits. And, you know, you had a tremendous amount of patriotism on the part of these women, which really, when you think about it, was remarkable because, first of all, just getting through the day in the 18th century was not easy. And they would get through these very difficult days with, you know, having to run a farm and raise children and make things in the household, manufacturing, because that's the way you got things, and get through this long, physically exhausting day, and then sit down by candlelight at night and write these remarkable letters filled with thoughts of what kind of government we should have and what the men should be doing to achieve those ends. And so it was such a sense of duty that I feel tremendously admiring of. And at one point, Abigail Adams said, you know, we women are really the best patriots because if we win, you men will be held in high regard and hold high office, and we won't even be able to vote. So we're better patriots than you are. And John agreed with her. But then you have people like Dolly Madison, who in the early days of the New Republic, when already we were in the kind of partisan polarization that we're in right now today, which was exacerbated by regional differences, she really made this fragile new country hold together by making the men who were fighting each other come together at her house, and first the Secretary of State's house and then the White House, to be together, make deals, talk to each other, and behave. And you can make the case that she really held the country together in those early years. But it goes on and on from there.
What we are hearing now is a murmur in the Democratic trenches of throughout, meaning the trenches of democracy, mm-hmm. throughout this country, that women in record numbers are coming forward to run for elected office.
Well, it's true. As we sit here talking today, you're having special elections in New York in 11 districts, and an awful lot of those candidates are women.
Yes.
And in some cases, it's two women. Also today, there's a special election in Arizona where the two candidates are women. So what you're seeing is a tremendous interest in the part of elective office among women. And we are seeing them run for Congress, for state legislature, for mayor, for governor in record numbers. That's absolutely the case. Now, whether they all sign up in the end, you know, but when all the filing deadlines
sure.
are done, we'll see. But an awful lot. But it's not just interest in running. It's also interest in talking about it, voting, getting out there. In this Arizona special election, it's a Republican district. In the last election, they had, I think the number is, the Republicans had something like 3,000 precinct captains, and the Democrats had 600. Now the Democrats are up to 1,700 in just 2 years. And that's all among these activist women who are very engaged.
So what do you believe is motivating that? I mean, we obviously are at a point also talking about women and women's rights and Me Too and so forth in our national dialogue and conversation. That plays a part of it. The Trump administration has to play a part in it as well. And I maybe I'm going one step too far, but is it also of, oh, we missed our chance to elect the first woman president?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's no accident that the Women's March was the day after the inauguration. And of course, the first big Women's March in 1913 was the day before Woodrow Wilson's inauguration to get the suffrage. But the fact is that a lot of women felt betrayed. Now, a lot of them hadn't voted, if the truth be told, a lot of the young women particularly. And there was this kind of sense of, oh, I don't like Hillary. That was very much part of the pattern. But even so, even the people who didn't like her much were disappointed at the outcome. And they did feel a sense of, this will never happen. We'll never have a woman president. And so they organized. And the part that's remarkable to me is how they've stayed organized, because I really did think it would be sort of a moment's march, and that was that. A lot of what has contributed to that is the Me Too movement, which, again, I thought might be a flash in the pan, and it certainly is not. And I think that there's this awakening on the part of young women and reawakening on the part of older women that, wait a minute, you know, the decks are not stacked favorably for us, and we need to fix it.
You, of course, are... And I don't know how you're going to react to this, but I mean, you...
I don't either.
But you were a pioneer in your own right. Well, I mean, sure. you come in and at a time where women are not in journalism.
Absolutely.
I remember you telling me a story once about those early days of at NPR. So what is it, what do you believe ultimately got you through that and allowed you to pursue exactly what you wanted to pursue?
Well, a couple of things. One was that NPR was a new organization, and so women could succeed in a way that was almost unique because there weren't men already in place. You didn't have to replace a man with a woman for a woman to have a job. It was a brand new job. Also, the pay was terrible, and you could get better women for bad pay than men. But I think the bottom line is I worked very hard and I was good at it. But I also had a cohort of female friends, Linda Wertheimer and Nina Totenberg being chief among them, where we held each other up and we had each other's back. And we could protect each other in situations that could be dicey. And that meant that nobody ever felt that she was crazy or, you know, maybe I'm wrong here. You had these smart women to bounce it off of, and they could tell you whether you were the one that was wrong, and most of the time you weren't.
So at a time in the last year and a half where we have heard these stories that have included our own organizations,
right,
including NPR, where men are behaving very, very badly, obviously this comes as no surprise, really, to most women.
Maybe particularly older women.
Particularly older women.
I mean, Linda Wertheimer tells an hysterical story of when she was very young and working for a senator, that he started chasing her around the desk, and he was so slow she kept catching up with him. But yes, the world of work that we went into as young women was blatantly, openly sexist. And harassment, the word didn't exist, and the activity was rampant. And so that was our world, and we all sort of gritted our teeth and lived through it. And it all got better. Not enough better, but a whole lot better. For young women, their basic reaction is, this shouldn't be our world, and we don't have to put up with any of it. And by any of it, they don't mean just blatant harassment, which we experience. They mean off-color comments that make them uncomfortable. Their view is, we don't have to put up with this, and, you know, God love them.
Equal pay, though, has a lot to do with this, doesn't it?
Sure it does. I mean, it's absurd that we are still looking at the pay differentials that we're looking at. And companies are constantly fighting dictates that say you have to publish salaries. Because once you do that, you see how unequal the pay is. And it turns out to be unequal at every level. And that becomes something that women can easily unite behind. Women of different political persuasions can easily unite behind the notion that this is just unfair and unacceptable. I mean, the notion that women don't have the same obligations as men, but also it's not nobody's business what obligations you have. You should just get paid for your work.
You have spent a lot of time, obviously, covering Washington, being a part of the fabric of the city and of our politics. And obviously, as we talked about earlier, we're in a tumultuous time. So where does journalists are supposed to be cynical by nature, but are you optimistic?
Oh, I'm such a Pollyanna, Joe. I just can't get over it.
some of that with us, Cokie.
I can't seem to get past it. Well, I do think that the founders had the right idea in terms of this separation of powers. And so what we do see is that even when the president seems to be doing something that people are looking at askance, that the Congress or the courts stop him in many cases. And we've seen that happen over and over and over again. And the other thing that I've seen that I'm really very, very excited about, really, is I think that the press has absolutely stepped up to the plate. Mm-hmm. That people are who used to be mailing it in are now really working and examining everything that's happening. And, you know, it's a dicey time to be called the enemy of the people. Is not something comforting. And what happens at Trump rallies in terms of the press is appalling. But the fact that it's made us all be much more on our game and be very, very, very careful to get things right so that there's no ammunition on the other side, the anti-press side, I think that's a good thing. So there's another cause of optimism.
When people are polled and ask their respective Congress and the press,
they hate them both.
They hate them both.
Right.
Do you see that changing though? Do you think they will be with them working harder that there will be an increased respect for?
In some circles, I mean, what I have had happen that's never happened to me before in my life. Over the last 18 months is people come up to me in airports and such and say, keep doing what you're doing. It's really important.
Right.
And I've never heard that before.
Mm. And again, that's something to hold on to, isn't
it? Yeah. It's just when you're really feeling depressed, yes.
Cokie Roberts is a commentator for NPR, a regular on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. What's the new book you're working on? Are you able to?
I'm working on a suffrage book. The centennial is 2020. And I'm focusing on a singular woman who you've never heard of. But she was in charge of ratification. And ratification turned out to be a very difficult road to hoe, too. So I'm excited about it. It'll be fun.
When it's out in the world, I hope you'll come back and talk to us about
it. I'd love to.
Cokie Roberts, a great pleasure to have you on the program.
So nice to be with you, Joe.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.